politically incorrect.
Correct.
This is Politically Incorrect with Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson on TNT Radio.
And hello to everybody, wherever you may be. It's Mike Tennessee here with my dear friend Richard Carson. And today we have a special guest, which I'll get Richard to introduce very shortly. But before he does that, I want to read you something. It's a poem that I found written by a man by the name of Ron Manners. And it's entitled, Who Wants Peace? And I thought you should listen to this for the start of this show. Peace is what we get at last when all else fails, lying there in that wooden box when they've hammered in the nails. But you can have peace any time you like, cycling by the river, you alone on your bike. No, we seek something more. There's something we really crave. And it's probably been that way since men, women sheltered in the cave. So what we really seek is harmony, entirely different from peace. And when we make this great discovery, life's wonders never cease. And that was written by a man named Ron Manners. Now, my dear friend Richard, I want you to introduce our special guest today. Mr. Manners has a CV a mile long. He's a very, very well-known miner and a major in just about everything else. So over to you, Richard.
With that little bit of background harmony, I can give you a little bit of background on why we're having a quick chat today, and hopefully it won't be quick. It might go for a couple of hours. I know this bloke could probably talk for 7 or 8 months. but I was having Christmas lunch, I think, with Ron's niece, Bianca. I think I'm right in saying that.
Yes,
and she kindly brought a present, very kindly, and it happened to be a book called The Lonely Libertarian, which I finished reading the other day. And it's a traverse of the gentleman whom we're chatting to, Ron Manners' life. It's an astounding story. And you and I, Mike, aren't going to get too far involved in the conversation because this bloke can probably, I'll say he can probably talk the leg off an iron pot, but more importantly, he is fooled with knowledge, history, background, and a bloody great story. So, Ron, I'd love you to start. I don't know where to start with you, but there's lots of little tidbits I was astounded at. And if I can go back to when you were about 16 years old, you were unpacking a crate in a warehouse, probably your father's warehouse or something or other, and you were dragging something out of a box and you started reading a piece of paper, and from there your life went ballistic. So I'll give you the floor, and if we think there's something we need to come in on, we'll give you a yell. But go back to when you were about 16 years old and you were unpacking a carton or crate or something, or other mining equipment, I think it was, because the stories that you have locked away in your head are brilliant. So give us a bit of background and go where you like, because we're all ears.
Well, thanks, Richard and Mike, for having me on board today. I think of myself not so much as a speaker, but more of a listener. There's just this is such an incredible world into which we've been born, and the actions, the what's been happening in the world during our lifetimes is just unbelievable. People from previous centuries would just not have believed it, and there's no need to exaggerate anything at all, because everything within the last, say, 50 years or so is just it's just been moving so fast, and the wonderful thing is it's speeding up too. That's a plus. But
that's a bit of worry for we young fellows. It'll catch up and bite us on the bum.
I'll tell you what it does. It makes you really value every birthday, because there's become such a scarcity of birthdays. Each of them becomes so damn valuable. So there's something to look forward to. But you asked me, it probably is true that I was growing up in Kalgoorlie, and I'm a fifth generation guy in the mining industry in our family, so it's probably
for our listeners. You've been going, your mob's been going since 1895. There aren't too many like you out there, and never mind Australia, northern, southern hemisphere.
That's where my grandfather started the business in the gold fields. He, 1895, it probably doesn't sound so long ago, but it's 6 years before Australia had a flag and six years before we had a constitution. So I guess it is a long time. And being the fourth generation in the family business, I wake up every morning and in terror that it's the third and fourth generation that usually has the reputation of smashing the business.
But Ron, anyway, for the benefit of it's Mike here, just for the benefit of those listening, we ought to just put a bit in perspective. Kalgoorlie is a very major gold mining town over many, many years in Western Australia, a big state. My understanding was that your grandfather went to Kalgoorlie from Victoria originally?
His family came from Victoria, from Ballarat, which was also a major
gold mining centre when gold was discovered in Australia all that time ago.
Yeah, his father was involved in the Eureka Stockade and had a bit of trouble with the police.
Yes, well, that's another story in itself. And we can't spend all afternoon on that, but I suspect that our listeners might want to Google up the Eureka Stockade. It's good reading.
It's the only revolt that Australia's ever had that really worked. Anyway,
we'll come to that too.
I just was working after high school when me and my dad's mining engineering business. So I was opening these wonderful big crates of mining equipment we were importing from America. And that was way back in the days before there was bubble wrap and proper packing material. Packing material to stop all this machinery from rubbing against each other was crumpled up paper, magazines and things that I smoothed out some of this stuff. I took it home and read it and smoothed it out. The magazine was called The Freeman. It was the monthly publication of a foundation, the Foundation for Economic Education in the US. And it had stirring stuff about the individual responsibility and how we're responsible for ourselves and how we should never blame anyone else for our misfortunes. And I took that home and I loved it. That was just so magic words. I never heard stirring words like that. And a couple of years later, I got to be the editor of the Kalgoorlie School of Mines, which is a sort of a semi-university college. And I got to be the editor of the magazine there, so I started using some of this stuff. And, well, I nearly got run out of town. This is a highly unionized town. For anyone to suggest that you could be successful without using, calling on the union muscle and pushing other people around I was in a bit of trouble. So I said, well, these ideas are not much good. They're getting a bit of trouble. So I typed out a letter and I wrote it to the president of the Foundation for Economic Education. I said, listen, mate, your ideas are not much good. They're getting me into trouble. And, some months later, because it used to take a long time to get replies to letters back then, I got a lovely letter from the president. He called me Mr. Manners, not realising I was about 17 by that time. He said, no. Our ideas are okay. They say it really started by Aristotle and they've been polished up by so many people over the years. And he said, if you're having a bit of trouble, all it indicates to me is that you haven't enough knowledge to defend your own position. If you want to have a position in life, you've got to have the knowledge to back it up and defend yourself. And he said, with that in mind, I'll put you on our mailing list and I'll start off by sending you a few books and you get a Freeman magazine every month, and if you ever have any questions, write to me. Well, that started a very long relationship with Leonard E. Reed, the president of the Foundation for Economic Education. He was a very patient person, and he replied in great detail to every one of my letters over those years, right till his death in 1983. As many, many years. And the little snippets of information and guidance that he gave me, they ring true in my mind to today. For if you said, what was one, I would say that he said, Rob, don't be pushy. You haven't got a license to change anyone in the world other than yourself. He said, all you can do is bring an idea to the threshold of someone's consciousness, and then you have to back off and leave it to them to decide. Because if they accept that idea, it will be with them for life. And since then, I've been pretty casual. I don't mind what sort of opinions people have. I appreciate that we all have different opinions. But if I can sense that they can't defend their philosophies and their choices in life, I don't mind giving them hell, because sometimes it's just a fun thing seeing people fall apart. I mean, if you tackle some of these climate catastrophists and a lot of these people that talk about social corporate responsibility and all these jargon words that have been caught up, they haven't got the knowledge of the scientific background to back their things. I've been around long enough to know how some of these fads start. And in the mining industry in particular, they started this corporate social responsibility, developed into something called a social license to operate. And the mining industry designed all these concepts themselves as a way of freezing out the small emerging mining companies so that they wouldn't compete with the big mining companies. The big mining companies used to go to these governments of these various, might be African or South America or former Soviet Union countries. The big companies went and say, listen, you can't deal with these little companies. They haven't got the capacity to earn a social license to operate. It's a phrase they came up with to keep the little guys out. So now when I
just on that point, if I may, they seem to forget that they were a little guy at some stage. that's a minor issue. It's all very well being a monopoly, but at some point you weren't. And the actual art of having a bit of competition in the marketplace stops you from becoming a lazy buffoon.
But they need these little companies. The big companies never make discoveries. It's the small companies who make discoveries. The big companies then come and buy them out and take them over. Anyway, so that's about how most of these things start. And it got me, I've always been interested in economics. And there's a consistent pattern with all these fads and scams and things. They're confidence tricks played on us, the taxpayers. And the thing in common with them all is explained in the particular branch of economics called the public choice theory. Now, that's not quite known. Not many universities actually teach that in the economics courses. I think it's mainly because it explains how universities operate, and I can come back to the education system later. But public choice theory explains how the concentrated benefits of any legislation or any act of parliament or any law or rule, the concentrated benefits always go to a very select few. And those select few work their guts out to make sure that legislation is passed or comes into being or extended and just keeps rolling on. And they are, in the design of all these policies, they're careful to design the costs to be spread over many millions of people like us. So it only costs us a few dollars a week. So we never march in the street because it's not life-threatening. And there's so many suckers, we're all carrying this little bit of burden. So we don't become very proactive in this, but my God, the people that are getting the concentrated benefits, they don't slack it off. They just keep on rolling, keep screwing it up, and why more subsidies and more help. Anyway, that's the the thing in common with all these scam things that are burdening us down, we're carrying them on our back. And this is why Australia, we should be rating up there in the top productivity countries of the world, because the, our production is assisted by scale. Our mines and everything we export, our farming, everything is done on a huge scale. We've got that scale. We should be the most productive country, but we rank about 11th in the world, which is absolutely disgusting.
I think, Ron, what's the real reason why that is so? You say we should be amongst the biggest in the world, and we're not. Why is that?
Well, we're carrying all this unproductive burden on our back. The forms that we have to fill in, just in the normal way of business.
You're talking about bureaucratic bullshit.
That's a wonderful term. I wish I could. But with my name of manners, I've got to be very polite, very careful in my choice of words.
You know, Ron, the fact of the matter is I was always told that manners don't cost you anything, but bureaucratic bullshit certainly costs us a lot.
Here's an example. When I was running a mining company, I noticed that we had two or three members of the staff filling in these government forms. And it was called the annual exploration returns that we had to submit every month. And I said, what's all this stuff? And they said, we have to explain how many metres of drilling we do, rotary drilling, reverse circulation drilling, diamond drilling. We have to divide all the different types of drilling so we can fill it in, because that's what we have to do. They're the columns. And I said, we've got in our cost structure, we've got one code for drilling. We don't care what sort of drilling we're doing, because the results from yesterday's drilling will dictate the type of drilling we'll be doing tomorrow. And they said, no, we've got to break it up like this. And I said, do you have any idea how much this has cost to filling in those forms? And they said, oh, yeah, that doesn't matter, because we've got to do it, otherwise we'll be fined. I said, read the bottom line. So right down the bottom line, it said the penalty for not filling these forms and getting them in time is $100. And I said, I just estimated the cost of filling in these forms $15,000, whether you guys are sitting around, and the penalty is $100. I said, every month when they arrive, put them in the bin.
How'd that go, Ron? Did they bin them?
We never filled another form in.
Yeah, that's good. You know, that's probably why. I'm going to cut in here, if you don't mind, Richard, quickly.
No, go.
Because I think our listeners need to know how important this man is and has been, and how he became so important. Just if I start towards a little while ago, in 2020, Ron Manners made an Officer of the Order of Australia in the 2020 Australia Day Honours for distinguished service to the minerals and mining sectors and to youth through philanthropic support for educational initiatives. Now, that's quite a slate, Ron, and we congratulate you on that. And I think people in other parts of the world who have their own honours system will appreciate that to be appointed an Officer of the Order of Australia in that way probably only scratches the surface of your achievements. But in any event, congratulations. Now, before then, of course, you were elected the mining legend at the 2005 Excellence in Mining and Exploration Conference in Sydney, Australia. And in 2012, my understanding is that you defended Gina Rinehart, who we know to be a mining magnate in Australia and one of the wealthiest women around, in her bid to invest in a media company called Fairfax against our then Treasurer, Wayne Swan. Tell us, I'll have to get you to tell us a little bit about that, because we love politicians on this show.
We don't.
Most of them have a lot to be said about them, but not much to be said for them.
Correct.
Is that correct, Richard?
That's very spot on, Mike. That's brilliantly well put.
Just going back a bit further, I mean, you have floated a number of mining companies yourself, Ron, and between 1985 and 2005, that's 20 years, you served as the chairman of one of the biggest mining companies you created, called Croesus Mining, no liability, a gold mining company. So tell me if I'm wrong about any of this, but can I just go back quickly to that time where you had to defend Gina Rinehart against Wayne Swan, that wonderful politician from Queensland, no doubt.
You've been very generous.
I think it was just fascinating how these people, how politicians decide to make decisions, that these decisions are best made by the people, by the investors, the people who've got some skin in the game. Probably takes me back to I had a farm in Esperance down south of Kalgoorlie for many years, and I was chopping little bits off and selling them, subdividing the farm to feed my family, because I was had a bit of problem with the taxation department for about 7 years that froze me out of the workforce, but that's a different story. Was the Department of Conservation and Land Management. It kept blocking my desire to cut little bits off and sell them to people who wanted to have small farmers. And I was getting quite angry with them over the phone. I said to the senior person, I said, listen, if you feel as though you should be making the decisions about what happens with this land, you must bear in mind that the owner, you should be the owner of the land, and then you can make all the decisions you like. But I said, I'm the owner, and I should be left to be able to make some decisions. It's a freehold. I own it. I pay for it. I don't owe anything on it. So I should be able to make some decisions. And there was this silence. And then he said, you mean, would you sell it to us? I said, well, of course I would, because I can't do anything with it at the moment. You've got me over a barrel. Of course I'll sell it to you. He said, well, we'll come back to you tomorrow with an offer. So they came back the next day and they offered me, and I gratefully accepted, because that it was the end of a bureaucratic battle that was sort of getting me nowhere. So that's the thing. There is property rights infers an ability to make a decision, whether it's the right decision or the wrong decision, but you make it as owner, or you paid the money, you acquired some ownership aspect. If the decision goes bad, you've got to wear that. You can't blame anyone else. But in almost every aspect of our lives, we can make a transaction. Sometimes down the bottom, it's subject to a review by a certain government department. Well, what the hell's it got to do with them? You know, if you break the law and you adversely affect anyone else's property rights or their health or their body in any way, we've got a perfectly good legal system. And that's what the legal system is there for, to arbitrate between me. But this stuff of the government making all their decisions, that Professor Hayek, one of our favourite economists, said that the knowledge in society trickles down, and the knowledge is out there with amongst all the millions of us. There is no such person who is qualified to be president or a politician to make decisions for you, because all that information is not with them. It's out there in the marketplace, and we vote with our dollars. We influence people. This company succeeds because we back it, because it gives good service, and that's what a marketplace is for. It's not for governments to come in and pick their favourites and say you must deal with this person and not deal with this person. Really, it's very simple when you think about it. Also, that's where came back to that. Somebody had some property rights. They wanted to buy some Fairfax shares. Good on them, because Fairfax wasn't looking too smart as a company at that time.
They were struggling. They were serious.
Yeah.
Ron, just quickly, I think we're going to go to a break, are we?
Yes, we are, Richard.
I was just going to make a quick observation that Ron's book is called The Lonely Libertarian. And that, to me, is the essence of how the man has lived his life, and the essence of what he's talking about is the decency of being a productive person.
That's and a great lead into the next topic, I think, Richard. And is it? We'll have a break.
We'll have a quick break and come back.
And we'll come back with Ron if he doesn't mind.
You've got a very good memory, so you recall what I was just rabbiting on about.
We'll
be back in a second, Ron.
All right.
Okay.
Trish Wood on TNT Radio.
I thought, well, that's kind of like the end of the war. And then there was another piece that I saw in, I believe it was the Jerusalem Post, which said that two sides are still talking at very high levels. So what I'm wondering is, why am I having to look for that kind of information? Why isn't that top of mind during the newscasts who are instead focusing on refugees and crying babies wrapped in Ukrainian flags waiting at the border? I mean, it would seem to me that those concessions by Zelensky might be a game changer.
Well, yes, but it's a game changer that doesn't favour the current geopolitical, should we say, motivations and aims of the US at the moment.
Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Mama, what does the chicken say? Dog. Cat. Giraffe.
Giraffe, really? Giraffe.
You're not going to get it all right. Just make sure you nail the big stuff, like making sure your kids are buckled correctly in the right seat for their age and size. Get it right.
Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
They come by sea to bring hope and healing. They're mercy ships, a team of dedicated volunteers who donate their time to provide free surgeries. Volunteers like Rachel Greenland.
There's something that you can't even describe about seeing a life change so much.
Mercy Ships is launching a new hospital ship, but we urgently need 3,000 volunteers from medical staff to galley cooks. If you feel called to help change lives forever, go to mercyships.org/volunteer.
If you want the jibby jab, all right, enough, then you've come to the wrong station. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And welcome back. You're with Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson and our very special guest, Ron Manners, AO, a man of great mining history. Now, Richard, before we went to the break, we were about to talk about loneliness and a book that Ron referred you to. I'll let you go back to that topic.
Well, where I was coming from is, as we listened to Ron talk about his whole life experience, the book he wrote was The Lonely Libertarian. And I suppose libertarianism is a rather, I would call it a foreign topic to the vast majority of our bureaucracy and our government, because it doesn't suit the theme of people getting off their tails and being industrious, employing people, and being all-round productive members of our society. And in Ron's book, there are many, many facets to it. But the first premise, and I think it's on page one or two of your book, Ron, it says, "Why the lonely theme?" And I guess that's about the libertarian spirit. You are often alone in your thinking, but not alone in your general feelings of how you're going through your life. Would that be a fair assessment of how you started with your book?
Yes, really. A libertarian is someone who's worked things out for themselves and really doesn't need a mob. We're not part of the mob rule stuff.
It doesn't apply to our politicians in any way, shape, or form.
Oh, yes. Well, they think the minute they've got 51 votes, 51% of the votes, they can do anything they like to the other 49%. But a minority is a person of one. So they've got to be respected just as much as the people who've got 51 or 49%. So I think if we can diverse the decision-making process down to the individuals, we'll need less and less reasons to go and enlist aid from this mob rule, which is a which is a worry in democracy that it can develop into something like a mob rule.
I think we've lost the way in the last 25, 30 years, especially here in Australia, but all around the, you know, we're Northern Hemisphere, we're chatting to everyone all around the world at the moment. And what we're seeing is appalling management of people. I was just going to read, if I may, one little thing I noticed in your chatting or talking about, I think it's Professor Hayek, state control of economic life cannot enhance human well-being. It can only bring misery and poverty. That's a great statement, and you recorded it in your book, and I noted it very quickly.
Yeah, well, that probably explains there's a few things happening over there and between Russia and Ukraine at the moment, and people are trying to work out what's on Putin's mind. He's not acting like a sane, sensible, not acting like a human being at all, but you've got to bear in mind that what's driving him, he wants to limit the spread of what he calls democratic contagion. because if you go to Russia, where the people in the street don't smile, and then you go to Ukraine, where I've been quite often on a lecture tours, you go to Ukraine, the young people in particular are smiling.
I think this is something we want to touch a lot on your time in Russia, but keep going on that point for the moment.
So that's the difference. So that's probably where we. You've got to explain why you can be lonely, but you can be very happy about being lonely.
Well, many of us are. I mean,
If you've got confidence and self-esteem, you can be absolutely comfortable, and you find that attracts other people. It's an attractive aspect. That's why I'm trying to be alone. I'm never not allowed to be alone.
Well, I know the feeling. Often I go to a party. I don't get invited out that often, but occasionally I do. And I'm just as likely to go and sit in the corner, and then every bugger wants to come and talk to you, and you're having a quiet rum and coke. You think, come on, give me a break.
It's absolutely true, sir. The lonely libertarian was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, because on the cover I'm surrounded by the...
And 800 young people.
These young people, they say, how could you be lonely? I say, each of those young people who are our MedCal scholars for that particular year, each of those young people know exactly what I'm talking about when I say you're alone, because they go back to their universities or to their families or to their groups or their friends, and what they're talking about is almost alien to all the general thinking that people get sprouted at them on a daily basis. So it's like our vets when they came back from Vietnam some years ago, they couldn't find anyone who could actually talk to them at the same level. You know, there was a sense of loneliness there. Yeah. So,
it took a long time for them to be even recognised, let alone respected.
My next book, which is half done, is called The Impatient Libertarian, because the older you get, the more impatient I become. So,
you're probably looking down the time tunnel of the salt thing that you turn over and it dribbles along at a steady pace. That's what your problem is, eh? Ron, in being all of these things that you've done, along the way, I wrote a couple of thoughts down, how you being an independent mind and doing so much on your own, do you get very depressed about our governments being, well, just more moribund, for want of a word, wasting hundreds of billions of dollars in taxpayer funds? You touched on, you know, you pay your own way. Well, in reverse to that, being a person who's done so much in their life, looking at what we have in our collective leadership, it is very, very distressing and it comes back to that little quote from Professor Hayek, too much government, too much overburden on individuals. How do you feel, you know, is there some way we can start to address all this rubbish?
I start every day by just thinking how lucky we are. We're all lucky. We're lucky to live in Australia. It's still a remarkable country where you can go out, you can start with nothing, you can end up with everything. But so many people get sidetracked. They get hijacked. They get belted over the head by either the bureaucracy or government or occupational licensing and all these things. I think you've just got to be strong enough to just go walk straight on through these things. Ayn Rand, who is a very powerful writer, and she was a powerful writer of the whole libertarian
concept. Ayn Rand, yeah.
Yeah. And she said in one of her quotes, I'll always remember it, is they can only do to you what you let them do.
Right.
And that's it. They can. The stuff that they do, I came back through I think every state of Australia has got a thing called G2G pass. So you come back into Australia or you come back into your state, you've got to fill in all these forms and you've got to wear masks and you've got to do certain things within 7 days and a whole lot of stuff. I started querying one of the bureaucrats who was telling me all this. And if you read the bottom of that form, it says the penalty for breaching any of those rules is $50,000 or 12 months in prison.
Mm.
That's the penalty. And I said, the average person could unwittingly break some of those regulations. There are so many. And he said, don't really worry about them because most of them are unenforceable anyway.
Despite the fine.
I said, can I quote you on that? He said, yeah, they were enforceable when we first brought them in. They've been appealed against. But I said, why are they still there? He said, well, if you had all that control, would you willingly give it up? He was talking to the wrong guy because I wrote it down.
And this is in the last 18 months or something, wasn't it?
This is in November.
November of last year. Yeah. Mike, you had a bit of a similar situation coming back from wherever you were on one of your many jaunts where you were challenged in the customs or something or other, something similar. Yes. But they didn't really enforce you. They just brushed you on.
Oh, yes. No, they had me. It was a mistaken identity.
Oh, right.
There was somebody they were looking for who had the same name. And all I could say to them was, well, he's a lucky fellow, but he may not be as lucky as I am if you let me go. Well, yes, you've got to be very careful with authorities. I mean, must admit, I know a very good friend of mine had a brush with, not so much, well, I think their authority, but it was a council. They put up some obstruction on their footpath to prevent heavy trucks from driving over a pristine lawn, which had been looked after by the owner. The next door allotment was being rebuilt on and, you know, very, very heavy machinery and trucks was coming across and they just cut the corners and go straight over this fellow's lawn. So he built a little triangle out of very light garden stakes, painted them white. And this very officious council employee came and said, look, I'm here to tell you, you must take them off because it's an obstruction of the footpath and somebody may trip over it and hurt themselves.
Yeah.
Well, that wouldn't care about the lawn that the fellow whose lawn it was spent hours looking after on the council footpath.
Well, helping them out.
The only decent lawn in the street, and he had irrigation systems in there and so on. Yeah. She said, look, I appreciate that. There's nothing I can do. I'm only the messenger. So when they were asked, well, who made the complaint? Is it someone in this street? Because it wouldn't be. And the person said, the officer said, I can't tell you that for privacy reasons. That's bureaucracy for you. I thought that was a terrible story.
Splendid.
I'm only glad it wasn't me. I think I'd have been a little bit more more forceful and a little bit more vocal.
I collect stories like that because they're lighthearted, but I try not to let it get in the way of what I'm doing. You got to do your day job first, and then all
exactly
of a sudden.
Right. Yes, right, wrong. Anyway, I digress. Go back, Richard. We need to find out more about
Now, I wanted, not only the loneliness side of it, but I've read in Ron's book, and I think this is a classic, when he was wanting to get the Croesus Mining Company up and running. This is Ned Kelly country here. You didn't have the funds, but you had a very good, strong opinion on the leases that were being put up. But you had to get some money or the appearance of having some cash, and you did something quite extraordinary with some sort of a deed of guarantee from the Westpac Bank. Now, that was the start of Croesus Mining, I understand, and you went and you didn't steal a document, but you took it and borrowed it for 4 or 5 hours. This is a classic, and I love the story, because from that point on, away you went with an amazing company. Yeah. But you, the start of it was, I would have called it a very brave bet.
I can make a very simple story of it, but it was a little bit complex.
It was bloody complex.
We were the only company, only mining company that listed in Australia, that's publicly listed, in 1986. They were pretty tough times. So we raised about $2 million. So we drilled a lot of our properties, and we were not successful in finding any gold. So we were running out of money. We just about had run out of money. And I was aware of I was watching very closely, because we were had the ground surrounding a particular asset that was owned by a much larger company called Rio Tinto, their subsidiary at the time. And it was an asset that didn't really belong within Rio Tinto. They were too big. That was an asset that I used to think, well, if a company our size had that, we could really make a success of it. There was some changes at the top in Rio Tinto, and got a new chairman. The new chairman came in and said, look, we don't want all these sort of assets, put them on the market. So this one went on the market, and I thought, well, this is our chance, we better get this. So I went and saw them, and they of course looked at our balance sheet. We had no money to pay for it. And they said, well, that's why we need the asset, so we can generate some cash and be where you guys are. And they said, well, we can't even put you on the tender list. So I said, what are we going to do to get on the tender list? And I said, you've got to have a bank letter of credit. And I said, oh, okay. So I went up the other end of St. George's Terrace to our bank, and the bank said, oh, we can't give you a letter of credit because you've got no cash to bank it up with. I said, that's why we need the letter of credit. And they said, oh, we can't give it to you. And I said, well, how much would you charge us if we just borrowed a letter of credit till 12 o'clock tomorrow? And they said, this is highly irregular. And they left me sitting at the boardroom. They went and had another meeting around the corner, and they said, this guy's mad. Let's go charge him $25,000 to borrow a letter of credit as long as he brings it back by midday. And they came back, and they knew that that would dissuade me, you know, having to pay $25,000 to borrow a letter of credit. And I said, no, they say, so I had a checkbook there, ran out a check for the $25,000, gave it to them, and they gave me a letter of credit. So I walked out of the terrace, went up the other end to Rio Tinto's office, and said, there you are, put us on the tender list. And they said, well, this is terrific. And so they put the letter of credit in their file. They were just going to walk out of the room. I said, no, hang on. that's mine. That letter of credit is mine. It's not yours. You can photocopy it, but you can't keep it. And they said, oh, that's okay. So they photocopied it and gave me the original back. I got it back. I'm not sure what the penalty would have been if I hadn't got it back at 12:05. But anyway, I kept going. We were on the tender list, and we tendered. And I was confident I knew I wasn't supposed to have looked at the drill results, but I knew all their drilling results. You find out these things if you live pretty close to a situation. So I was confident that that was okay. So we put a tender in, and I worked out a maximum price we were prepared to pay, but we tendered for that price plus 5% more than any other bidder. And they wouldn't accept the tender. They said this tender is not within the framework of our request for a tender. It's irregular. And I said, no, just a minute. You can't knock it back because you are there to act on behalf of your client, which is Rio Tinto. You're not there to act on behalf of anybody else or set in judgment of any. It's your client you've got to be acting. And if my tender says 5% more than anybody else, then it's legitimate and it's in your client's interest. And they had another meeting and they said, well, you're quite right. So we got the tender. But anyway, there's another story of how we managed to get that off the ground. But we paid back. We mined gold out of that asset quickly. We mined gold and we paid back all the debt within 9 months. So
that was a well spent $25,000, as it turns out.
Just think of what had happened if we hadn't got the tender. How would I explain that to the auditor? The auditor would say, "What's this expense of $25,000?"
The point was in all of that, though, Ron, was you stood up, you used your acumen area that you were looking to take over, and you got it right because you'd found out by stealth what was the assay value of that area, and then you went full steam ahead and prosecuted what you had. Was that the start of crate parisis? Was that where it all began?
It was our major leap. We had 10 days in which to pay the balance of the $21 million.
Wow.
And that was another challenge, but that came out of okay. I guess that's called entrepreneurship. You have a vision, and you believe in your vision to the point where other people can share that vision with you, and they will come along on your journey with you. And I got some terrific support during that 10 days, and we managed to have the $20.1 million. And there was a lot of money back in.
This is early 80s.
1986. There was a lot of money.
Yeah. And listen, there was I think there was someone in London who heard that you were doing this and got a bit grumpy with you for not cutting him in. So you did. Who was that?
Well, I was. That's what I was saying. It's another story getting the other $21 million. Yes. I was sitting. Having got the tender, I got the news that we'd been successful in the tender. I then sort of said, "Well, how are we going to do this?" And I'm just working out whose doors I could knock. And that's a lot of doors to knock on
to get
the money. And I got this call from this London stockbroker, quite abusive, saying, "Listen, you've done this deal. You've done this magnificent deal that they'd read about it in the Financial Times." And they said, "But you didn't give us a chance to be involved and participate. We got some of our clients would like to be in this." And I remember, I think I was in the toilet at the time because, of course, you get that funny feeling when you're in a tight spot. And I think I took the call and I said, "Listen, there's still time."
Am I all piled in?
Yeah, I said, as long as all the cash can be in our bank by 10 o'clock in the morning.
I'll let you join.
Yeah. That's the story of my life, but you really have to have confidence in what you're doing. You know, if if there had been no gold there, it would have been a disaster, you know.
But the point was, you had done a fair degree of due diligence. You had the confidence, but I was fascinated by how you went about getting the foot under the door, so to speak, because that was a bloody good bet, for want of a and Mike and I occasionally have a little flutter, that mainly on our wives' horses, because they go a bit faster than anything we know. But that would have been a better bet, wouldn't it, Mike?
I think so. That would have been a much better bet.
I think the ones we have, they tend to run down the back, keeping an eye on the ones in front. But never mind, that's okay. So Croesus then went on to bigger and better things, I think, from there.
It was a very successful company for about 20 years. I sold out. I must say, I sold out for one reason. I was thoroughly enjoying the gold industry. It's a wonderful industry to be involved in. It's vertically integrated. You can have a hunch, you can be a prospector, you can go and do exploration, you can find a few ounces, you can go and assemble a treatment plant, you can produce your own gold, and you can smelt it, and you can take it, and you can sell it to the refinery, and you can market it. It's like right from top to bottom. You can't do that with iron ore or nickel or anything else. Gold is the one fully integrated industry that you can just be part of every stage. So it's very exciting. But I ran into so much trouble with this what I regard as the totally unworkable Native Title Act, and that really I just couldn't stand it. It was the whole thing was badly. And I got a lot of friends. I went to school with a lot of Aborigines, and they're as incensed as I am about the unworkability of the Native Title Act. And if anyone thinks I don't know what I'm talking about, there's two books you've got to read. One is called Red Over Black, and the other one is called The Fabrication of the Aboriginal History in Australia. And if you get the background of both those two books, the last one, the first one was written by a reformed communist union organiser, and he explains the whole background to the Native Title Act was to split Australia into two, which is what's really happened in many ways.
So, Ron, to your knowledge, who actually drafted the Native Title Act? Who was responsible for the drafting of it? Do you know?
I should know.
But you may not know. Were they
was that back with
who were just employed to draft legislation? Were they people who had an insight into what was really required?
The philosophy of the whole Native Title Act was really driven by H.C. Nugget Coombs.
And
he was the driving force for it all. And it was this constant seeking of forgiveness, and we're so guilty about that stuff. The guy that wrote the more recent report called the Stolen Generation Report was a very good friend of mine since I was about age 17. His name was, he became Sir Ronald Wilson, but I knew him as Ron Wilson. Mm. And he wrote that report. And I...
He was a High Court judge in Australia, wasn't he?
Sure was. Mm. And a very humble guy. We were very good friends.
From West Australia.
Yeah, I said to him, I said, Ron, where did that title come from? Because the report doesn't talk about the Stolen Generation, but that's the name of the report. I said, where did you get that title? He said, I finished the report and submitted it. And they said, no, we need a catchy title because we've got to sell the report. We need a catchy title. And they suggested the title. I went along with it. Now, we had the Swiss National TV came to Australia to do a big program, and they interviewed me on camera, and they had, at that time, I was regarded as a mining leader, you know, for that time, and they they had me interviewed with someone who was an Aboriginal leader, and they had us both together, and they thought there was going to be a punch-up, but we both agreed exactly, and he said, I wasn't stolen, I was rescued.
Ron, we've got to go to the news. You're going to hang around, Ron, you'll hang around for another hour with us?
I'll stick around, I'll be doing this.
Okay, well, good
stuff. We've got a few very pertinent questions.
You might have them, I wouldn't have one.